everybody, and welcome to another episode of Horror Movie Night. It is 2021, and that means that for the first time ever, Fright Night is officially in our unwritten rule of 10-year gap between release. Obviously, there's been exceptions, but we try to stick within it. I want to say something real quick, and Brian and Scott can say that I'm completely in the wrong with this statement, but I want to clarify right out the gate that all three of us, as far as I understand, are in fact fans of the original Fright Night, but we also all believe that if you were to take off your nostalgia goggles for a second, that Fright Night 2011 is actually a better movie in almost every single way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're gonna spend the next 25 minutes telling you why.
Yeah, and I think that's it. Like, I'm gonna be coming down hard on Fright Night, the original, not because I hate the movie, but to make the comparisons of, like, where this movie succeeds, where that film only goes, like, half the distance to me. First and foremost, no Lisa Loeb in the original one.
Hell but... yeah.
So, already gets points for me right out the gate. No, so there is one thing that I think Fright Night does better than the 2011 Fright Night. There's some questionable things with the Peter Vincent thing. I get it. I don't love it. I like Peter Vincent as like a late night TV show host, but also there wasn't any of those in 2011. So I get having to change it. But the weird like Chris Angel magician thing.
Come on, man. I'm going to let you say your piece, and then I'm going to tell you you're wrong.
Yeah, just because of where the location is, it makes so much more sense.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Because I guess it makes way less sense that in the original movie they live right where they're taping this late-night horror show host that was a former actor's movie.
Yeah.
It makes way more sense to be in Vegas where there's a magician. But actually, I'm getting way ahead of ourselves. Scott, you picked this. Can you tell us why you picked it?
Yeah, it's been on my to-do list for a fucking year. I literally could go back. We won't. If we had all the time in the world and no real lives, less real lives than we currently already do, we could go back into our group chat, and I am pretty sure last January or February I was like, next year I'm going to pick Fright Night 2011.
Yeah.
I love this movie. I mean, I don't think it's a perfect movie at all. Don't let me get ahead of myself there. Like, the CGI is bad.
Oh, it's very bad. Yeah.
But and that's okay. Like, that is okay by me, because I think that the characterizations are better in this movie. It's one of those great remakes where they do fan service, but they also don't break your suspension of disbelief on why the characters are acting the same way 30 years apart or 25 years apart or whatever it
yeah.
is.
Oh, I mean, I think that we could almost do 25 minutes just on how the Evil Ed character is
improved. He's so much. I've hated Evil Ed in the original Fright Night since the first time I saw that movie, which was, you know, I think I was a sophomore in high school or something like that. I never understood why people thought that he was fun or cool or quotable, because the real takeaway from Evil Ed, first of all, is his "you're so cool, Brewster" line, which when you, like Matt said, if you take off your nostalgia goggles and rewatch the original Fright Night, Evil Ed's cadence of that line, his delivery is wrong. And then when you see McLovin do it, it's right. It's the whole fucking point of that line.
Yeah.
It's him being like, he's spitting out this, like, "you're so cool." Like, that's the whole point. And it's absolutely mind-numbing to me when people will shit on this movie and be like, "well, that's just fan service." No, they're basically taking something that was wrong in the first movie and making it right. That's my take on it.
Do you remember when Bill Hader was doing Al Pacino auditioning for Back to the Future?
Yeah.
That's how it was in the original, when he's like, 88 miles an hour. Great, Scott.
Yeah, it's, I mean, Evil Ed has so many good lines throughout the movie.
The remake, right?
In the remake, the two lines that I wrote down that made me just kind of chuckle was when he's like, "I didn't name him, I just report the facts," when they're like talking about his name being Jerry. And then the other one is like, he's yelling at Brewster about something, and he just ends it with, "and I'm like, seriously so mad that you think I retweeted."
Yeah, that was pretty funny. That was pretty funny. I don't know. I feel like you take some, my only issue with that character, and it's not even the character, it's just unfair. It's like, you take someone who's just so authentically themselves, right? Not a bad guy. His friend gets cool, leaves him behind. he ends up getting killed, but then he gets killed again, so he doesn't even get a happy ending. Like, Evil Ed just gets a shit
stick. But he didn't get a happy ending in the first
one. I know. I'm saying the character as a whole, you know?
Here's the other big thing. In both movies, Evil Ed is supposed to be a tragic figure, but in 20 minutes of this movie, they make me care more about Ed than the whole 90 minutes of the original movie. Like, you actually relate to him, because I think all of us have had an experience where one of our friends became too cool for us, and it was, like, kind of devastating. But, like, in this one, it's, like, even deeper than that. It's not just, like, hey, you abandoned us. But it's like, yo, one of our friends is probably dead and you don't give a fucking shit about it right now. Mm-hmm. And like, that's upsetting. And then like, I love when he actually has to get killed, he's telling Charlie it's okay. Like, that is like a heartbreaking death scene to me.
But also, you're missing the other best line in this movie right before, well, the scene before that, he goes, we could have rocked this evil shit together, which like... It's such a better character. I mean, that's what I think. The charisma of the actors is so different in both movies. Like, there are charismatic characters. There are charismatic actors in both, right? Like, I think Jerry is great in both. And I absolutely love that Chris Sarandon got to do a cameo and get fucking murdered by new Jerry in this. But, like, here's the interesting thing, kind of as a cultural microcosm of vampirism in the original versus the remake that I noticed this time around. I hadn't really thought too heavily about it because this is, like, my third or fourth watch of this version. But, like, Jerry Dandridge in the original is kind of a Victorian vampire, you know, like the seducer, the incubus. And that wouldn't necessarily fly as much in, you know, 2011, when also like in the grand scheme of what horror was right around the 2010s, you know, like we were getting torture porn, New French Extreme, stuff like that. And so they had to, and also we had 30 Days of Night. We had, you know, almost in a sense, 28 Days Later. I know that's zombies, but it's similar in like this kind of rabid monster concept. And I think that really is important, because to make this movie work, they had to have someone who had sex appeal, but also was incredibly menacing, because I never thought Chris Sarandon was menacing in the original.
No.
I think it's like a steal your girl kind of guy, but like, I absolutely love a vampire that is going to like just kind of give you, they truncate the story of finding out that he's a vampire, because they're like, this is a remake, we don't need to retread that too much. Like, the people that make the Spider-Man movies need to take a note from this movie, because we don't need to see Uncle Ben die again.
So here's something that's exciting news. So the director of this movie, Craig Gillespie, who made this movie, this is his second film. His first film is the reason why so many people agreed to do this movie, because they were all fans of it, which was Lars and the Real Girl.
Ooh, great movie.
Oh my God.
Great movie.
Seriously?
Yeah, so when he was like pitching people, they're like, the Lars and the Real Girl guy? Absolutely. And then he followed this movie with I, Tonya, which was also very good movie. Yeah. So the new movie he's making, which I am very excited for, it's going to be dropping on Disney Plus, is Cruella, starring Emma Stone, which is like the origin story of Cruella de Vil becoming who Cruella de Vil is by the time we get to 101 Dalmatians.
Now that is sick. I did not know about that.
Yeah, and I'm like, that is a fucking movie. Like, that's a movie where it's like, oh, great, so we're doing Maleficent with Cruella de Vil, but then when you're like, yeah, but the guy who did I, Tonya, Lars and the Real Girl and Fright Night remake is doing it, I'm like, okay, well, I'm interested now. Like, that thing's going to be... He's got this thing where it's like, I want to say that he's got a visual style, but it's almost that his visual style is that he just lets the scene play out the way the scene needs to play out. So, like, there's never, like, that's like the complaint that you would have with someone like on two ends of the spectrum, right? Like, with a Tim Burton, he's trying so much to have the Tim Burton flair that it's a distraction. Or, like, on the flip side, like a Kevin Smith, Kevin Smith's so focused on just focusing on the dialogue that nothing happens. But, like,
that was before. Now it's just the Remember Whens. That's all he's focused on.
That's all he's got is Remember Whens now. But, like, Craig Gillespie in three films has proven to be a guy who's just like, you don't need to do anything too flashy unless it calls for it. And that's what I like about this movie, is that, like, there are those flashy moments. Like, the scene in the car is fantastic, and it's constant moving, like, it's a constantly moving camera, and it's flashy and it's high energetic. But then, like, you don't need to put that exact same energy into, like, Ed and Charlie walking around the house.
Yeah.
You know, like, you just let him walk around the house.
I don't know if he's got the final say. Like, I don't know if the director has the final say in casting. I think he does, but that's another strong suit. Like, I feel like if it was 2010 and we did a draft of, like, vampire cast, none of us would pick Colin Farrell, but he's such a perfect choice. You know what I mean? Like, when you think about it now, you're like, wow, dude, he's got, like, the perfect
charm.
This
movie would not have worked out without him.
Yeah.
The casting, like, recasting Jerry Dandridge is so important. Like, from the writing to the casting of this movie, and the direction, obviously, but, like, I mean, and I miss Anton Yelchin more than I really should.
Me too. You know,
like, I wrote that, too. That was my first note, was, like, because I think we've said this on the show before, but I think it was Megan, you said he could have been our generation's Tom Hanks.
Like, he was actually, like, if he hadn't died, and it's a tragic death, like,
he could do it all.
And he did sci-fi, he did horror, he did drama, he did some comedy. Like, he was a powerhouse, and it just, and also he's, like, so likable.
Yeah, he's an actual average looking person. Like, he's more attractive than the average person, but, like, in that same Tom Hanks way in the 80s, like, he doesn't look like a superstar. He looks like the guy next door who's just a little bit more attractive than the regular person.
And he's an actor, like, he's like true to the art, where he's like, all right, I'm going to do Star Trek to pay my bills, and then I will just do indie films for the art of acting. Like, I feel like that was that's how he did it. He did, like, the one.
I don't know. I feel like I would do high sci-fi because it's fucking high sci-fi, you know? And I think he was also a big Star Trek fan.
Yeah, I think he was also a geek.
Like, true. I'm just saying, he did, like, a lot of, like, his independent movies are, like, the best.
Dude, I mean, Charlie Bartlett was the first thing I ever saw.
Oh, yeah. Charlie
Bartlett,
I was
like, this guy's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I miss Anton real bad. The other thing that we do have to talk about, and the way I worded it was, like, the pieces of the plot all fall into place so beautifully. Like, even something as small as, like, the very first time that you see Toni Collette, she's loading in those for sale signs.
Oh, the Chekhov's wooden stakes.
Yeah, like, it's like, it sets up the wooden stakes, but it also is, like, setting up the plot point of, like, people keep leaving town. Like,
and it, like, makes so much more sense in Vegas and instead of suburbia. Like, it's so much smarter. Like, I think that this movie, what I said earlier, what they did was they were like, how do we ground this a little bit more? And they were like, okay, where can we put this where people are out all night, sleep all day? You know, people are, we have a transient population. And it would just, and also you could have that Chris Angel douchebag character, because, like, that David Tennant, we haven't even said his name yet, but David Tennant steals every scene. He just shoots that scenery. It's so good. Yeah,
it's kind of a bummer that, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think that it's a bummer that this movie really didn't do amazing at the box office, because I feel like this was, like, the attempt to get David Tennant into, like, American audiences outside of just being the Doctor Who guy. And I guess because the movie didn't do well, I don't really see him in anything else.
He killed it in Jessica Jones.
Yeah, no, like, but I mean, like, he should be a movie star. You know what I mean? Like, he's got the likability to be a, like, hear me out on this weird casting, and he probably wouldn't do it because it's too close to Doctor Who. But, like, if for any reason Benedict Cumberbatch was like, I don't want to do Doctor Strange anymore, I'd be like, fucking David Tennant would crush it as Doctor Strange to me. Like, he would just be so weird and eccentric, and that's kind of what I want. I need David Tennant to play some type of Marvel villain, I think. I think that's
why.
What
don't
needs
we
to
get
happen.
Him to be, like, I know that Mordo is already taken in the Doctor Strange universe, but I'm sure that they can find some other dark magician to fight him. It would be the shit. Because, like, I see what you're saying about David Tennant killing it as, you know, the Sorcerer Supreme, but at the same time, I'm like, I can't see anybody except Cumberbatch in that role now. And, like, I remember years ago when they announced that, I was like, no fucking way. I that's not. It was also, here's the thing, is that Kevin Feige, I assume he kind of has executive say on all of the major castings. And so, like, when he picked RDJ instead of Johnny Depp for Iron Man, first of all, like, Johnny Depp is
retrospectively great call.
Yeah, like, but and Robert Downey Jr. is Tony Stark. I mean, he's the linchpin of the entire MCU. Like, if Iron Man 1 had not done so well, I mean, that was Jon Favreau probably, like, who made that casting decision, not Kevin Feige. But, like, at the end of the day, once a character is so perfectly matched, there's no way for someone to see them otherwise, to see that character otherwise. And that's, I think, Benedict Cumberbatch, because I've said it many times on the show, Doctor Strange is my favorite MCU movie, and it is the one that, I mean, like, the first one is the movie that I go back and watch the most. I know that that is controversial for most people because they're like, eh, but I love it because I love
it. I can't wait for the sequel. The sequel's going to be, like, the sequel's going to be one of those movies where if we're not out of the pandemic and they announce that they're releasing that in theaters, I'm like, am I about to risk my life to see this sequel?
Now, that is one of the few movies that I would be like, yes, I need to see this in theaters. Because it's such a brain twister and an eye banquet, I guess, is what you, like, it's a visual banquet, because, I mean, you need to see it on a big screen because there's going to be so much going on. They're going to ramp up the craziness 100-fold. I mean, it's called the Multiverse of Madness.
So it's and speaking of Multiverse of Madness, we're recording this just, what, 5 days before WandaVision drops?
Do not remind me. I'm so stoked. Like,
I saw this in theaters, actually.
This
was one of the movies I saw when I was living in L.A., and it was at actually one of the cooler movie theaters I'd ever been to, but I saw it in 3D, and it's probably one of the better, like, usages of 3D.
I didn't even know this movie was 3D.
Yeah, it was released specifically as a 3D movie, but again, when you do the 3D properly, it can transfer to a 2D movie without it being noticeable. So, first of all, just setting up the place. So, it was a normal movie theater, but their whole theme was like old Hollywood under the stars inside the theater. So, when you sat down in the seats, like, the walls were painted to look like old landmarks in Hollywood. But the really cool part was that the ceiling, instead of lights, like normal lights, was actually a series of very small lights, so it looked like stars.
Oh, that's cool.
So when they dimmed the lights, it felt like you were outside watching it underneath the stars for a couple seconds before they shut those lights off. But the way that the 3D would work, and the biggest one that I remember is when Doris explodes out of nowhere, is that it was built so that it felt like all the dust particles were floating around you every time that someone exploded. And it was just like cool shit like that. Like, that was how they would utilize the 3D, was like making you feel like you were there witnessing it as it happened, and not so much just like, bah, here's a yo-yo.
That's what I was about to say, is like, maybe that's the hallmark of a really good 3D movie, is that when it transfers to 2D, the effects are not in your face, you know. Like, I think that maybe, you know, if you're augmenting reality in such a way, maybe don't.
Yeah. Well, the car scene felt awesome because the way the camera moved, you felt like you were in the passenger seat of the car while it was happening.
A fucked up vampire hand. Now do you believe me?
I love that car scene. Like, I think that car scene is, like, one of the best suspenseful action pieces in a horror movie in, like, a decade.
You know,
like,
what else I love? Just so good. Tony fucking Collette.
Mm-hmm. Tony. So I read Anton Yelchin and someone else are the only people that didn't have to put on fake American accents. Like, so many of the stars in this movie are British actors or actors from other parts of Europe having to throw on fake accents.
Did you guys ever see that movie where he's, like, in a phone booth or something like that? That movie sucked.
Yeah, it was called Phone Booth.
That wasn't a bit, guys. Like, I seriously.
So the one thing I will say about the CGI, because I agree with you that for the most part, the CGI looks pretty bad. There's, like, a couple moments where you can tell that it's enhancing what's already a practical effect. But one of the pieces of CGI that I actually really do like is when Jerry gets impaled by the for sale sign and he's, like, all twisted up trying to crawl away. Yeah. It's, like, a very unsettling usage.
Yeah. And, you know, I also really love that you get to see how understated Jerry's vampire strength is. Like, yeah, he fucking throws a car door into the back of their, or no, it's a mm-hmm. wheel. It's a wheel. I mean, yeah, like, that's showing just how strong a vampire is. But what's really cool is that it's world building, in that they, like, when the first time you actually see him in action, if I remember correctly, is when he just walks straight into the backyard while they're all watching him, and he just starts digging up clots of dirt. Like, that's superhuman strength, and I loved that. And then he just he pulls up the gas line and he just lights it, and they're like, oh fuck, you know, like, it's such a such a clever way to do it. I absolutely love it.
So two things from the IMDb trivia about Colin Farrell, both that one is just like, man, Colin Farrell rules, and the other one is just the wording of it is really funny. So I'll read the funny one first. It says, Colin Farrell expressed concern that his character was too much like a sexual predator and requested that the script have some changes made. No changes were made. But then the other one says, Colin Farrell requested that he do a monologue in Latin, saying that it would be more menacing. He obtained a Latin tutor to teach him the monologue and studied the language on set. The monologue never made it to the screen, however. The Latin tutor was so fascinated by Farrell's ability to pick up Latin that she wrote a scholarly article detailing her time on the movie set.
Holy shit, that's wild. God love Toni Collette. You know, she's given us so many iconic horror movies. She was in The Sixth Sense as the mom. You know, that's taking us back to, was that 96 or 97, whenever that movie came out. That movie is iconic. It's dumb as fuck now, but like at the time, world changing for middle America. All right. And she gave us, and just let's bookend it. Hereditary, you know, like those two. I mean, she's done a lot of other shit. Don't get me wrong, but like two super, super important, super like culturally significant horror movies. She's just awesome. I fucking love Toni Collette.
Yeah, she's in like most of my favorite movies.
So the other thing that is here that was interesting, and I guess Steven Spielberg had some type of producer credit in some way, but it says Steven Spielberg only made two contributions to the film. First was that he wanted to insert the shot of the crucifix falling in the pool directly in front of the camera after Jerry attacks Ed. The other was that Jerry's fourth stage of makeup, when previewed, he said that it wasn't scary enough and insisted that the original concept of a shark-like jaw be put back into the movie.
That's fair. I mean, I don't love it. I don't love the effect.
No.
But it's, I really can look past it, honestly.
The effect looks better on Imogen Poots when she has like the throwback to the original movie jaw. Like, that,
you know,
looks
what's
a little
funny,
bit better.
If we're talking about vampire superpowers, did you notice that becoming a vampire makes your boobs grow exponentially? Crazy, guys. It's crazy.
I wasn't aware. I'll have to rewatch and pay attention. I've been thinking about this line a lot lately, and we won't get into politics, but...
Yes, we will.
There's a scene where Anton is trying desperately to convince Peter Vincent that the vampires exist, and he's showing him all this evidence, and he says a line where he goes, do you think that I want to know this shit? And like the way he says it is like so pained, and it's like, it makes me think of you know, on the Patreon episode with Kroll, when it's like, if you could have one wish, what would you wish for? And the Cyclops that sees the future says ignorance. Like, he is so pained by knowing this knowledge, and it would be so much easier for him to live a happy life just never knowing that Jerry was a vampire. But like, it's one of those things where like, once the bottle's open, you can't put that shit back. I love that line. And I think it's the most justifiable piece of character development of Charlie in either movie.
Absolutely. But then you get that kind of like that skepticism, which is weird because it's, I don't know how I feel. I'm not going to criticize this part of the storyline, but the fact that Peter Vincent's parents were murdered by Jerry, and that's what made him kind of like obsessed with the occult, I don't know if I love that. I think that it's a bit too coincidental.
That's a little rough. I do like in the original movie that it's just like, dude, I'm a fucking actor. Like I think that it's more entertaining when it's like someone who really doesn't know shit. Like, they've
been buying
their own bullshit.
Yeah, but I get that. But I'm saying, like, you could still have David Tennant's character have had his parents killed by vampires, and that's what led him to the occult, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit of like the Joker killed Batman's parents in the first Batman movie.
Yeah,
like,
that's fucking stupid.
It's a little too much.
It was never the Joker. If we're going to be comic book nerds, you know, if we're going to be nerds.
It never was.
It should have been
a Tim Burton invention.
Well, yeah, and if we're talking, we brought up Tim Burton twice in this episode, and can we just say that Tim Burton's a shitbag and move on?
So do we have any other last thoughts on Fright Night Beyond? Go check it out if you've been putting it off because you're like, I don't like remakes. And if And if you want to know about a couple other like decent remakes, hit up our Patreon where we're going to start the conversation there, but probably go into God knows how many other tangents. Patreon.com/HMN podcast.
Well, since this is my week, this was my pick, I get the illustrious first double feature, and I'm going to go with Evil Dead 2012. Is that what
Ooh.
It is?
Ooh. 2013, I think. But
2013,
yes.
Yeah. Because if I was doing a triple feature, it would be with Maniac 2012. So, like, those are they're all right around this. I mean, you could do Fright Night 2011, Maniac 2012, Evil Dead 2013, and do this, like, you know, litany of
in order
fucking in order of great release. Remakes year by year.
Brian, do you want to go?
Yeah, I'm just going to follow in Scott's footsteps and do Town That Dreaded Sundown remake.
All right.
Good call.
All right. I am going to not pick a remake, but I'm going to pick another movie that paired up Anton Yelchin and Imogen Poots. Green Room.
Such a great movie.
Delightful movie. Delightful movie.
Is that
well,
the
actually,
one?
Not delightful.
Wait,
but...
is Green Room where they sing Nazi punks fuck off?
Yes.
Yep. Yes. And Patrick Stewart plays the head of a Nazi cult. Yep, that's
yeah.
the one.
Yeah, I've never seen the whole thing, but I definitely watched Anton Yelchin sing fucking Nazi punks fuck off with Maybe, and I was like, I think I saw everything I need to see from this film.
Have you seen Blue Ruin, Scott?
No.
I don't know if you would like it.
I haven't. I haven't even seen Blue Ruin.
Oh, it's awesome. It's the movie he made before Green Room.
Right.
And it's a revenge movie, but it's like a more realistic revenge movie, which makes it more fun. It's like not like, hey, because you know how it's like, hey, look at Straw Dogs, perfect example, like, hey, here's like a pushover, but like all of a sudden, you know, revenge gives him the strength to like kick ass. Like it's a guy trying to get revenge for his family, but is an average guy, so he doesn't have like this like martial arts badass Sylvester Stallone fucking strength. He's like doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. You know, like can't cock a gun, can't. It's, but it's like really, really, it's really well done.
Nice. I know I want to check that out. But Scott, what did you watch this week that you want to tell people about?
All right. So I just want to talk for a second about how hilarious Megan and I, our Netflix algorithm must be, how fucky it must be, because we binged Bridgerton in about 3 days, and it was great. Have you guys watched Bridgerton?
Mm-mm.
Not yet. Everything that I've been seeing about it, I know I need to check it out. My friend Brooke texted me at work the other day and was like, because I've watched Bridgerton, I am now weirdly obsessed with the Vitamin String Quartet and listening to a bunch of their covers. So I know that there's a bunch of Vitamin String Quartet style covers throughout.
Super, super cool. Their cover of Thank You Next is absolutely perfect. So yeah, Bridgerton's fun. It's also frustrating. It's fun because it's a period piece, and it's just rich people being naughty, you know. The costumes aren't great because Megan and I, when we watch shit, we watch to look at the costumes, you know, and Megan is a huge Mad Men aficionado, and so she's always honed in on whether or not the costuming is good. And costuming is not good, but it doesn't matter because it's kind of like this. Oh, you know, in Hollywood, that was the Netflix show, right? Was that?
Yes.
Hollywood
yeah.
was not. It's kind of like an alternate reality where, you know, people of color actually have a say in life. And Bridgerton isn't either. Bridgerton was produced by a black woman. I can't remember her name or the name of her company, but Megan knew some of the stuff that she'd already done. And so there are like black nobles in it. And that's obviously not something that would have truly been in you know, like I think it's 1800s, like
yeah.
that. But like there would be no nobles. Like the Duke would not be black. You know,
yeah.
it's just
no,
not
that
a
makes
thing.
Sense.
So, but it's cool. It's like a reimagining.
Nice. I know that I want to watch it, and I want to watch it soon.
Yeah, you should watch it soon. Like the stakes are low, you know, and they'll do another season. It's fun. But
that's the way I like
we
it.
We immediately jumped from there to Sabrina season 4. And I feel like Netflix is like, why? You know, because like they could not be more dissimilar. Bridgerton is basically for the 30 plus crowd. And Sabrina has gone from being kind of like an all ages horror to basically being Riverdale with shitty demons in it. And season 4 episodes in. I may finish it on my own, just like slog through it, because it's not as bad as season 3 so far, but it's bad. It's just Riverdale. Nobody's likable. You know, like they've neutered all the fun characters. Reverend Blackwood doesn't even get to be crazy and over the top anymore. You know what Brian said months ago? He was like, Netflix can't not take a good show and ruin it.
Yeah, like I didn't even know if season four was good or bad, unfortunately, because I put on the first episode. I didn't care. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I don't care either. I literally am. I want to see the Eldritch Terrors.
Yeah,
and like, I'm waiting. I'm waiting for them to be good. And there are so many choices, like stylistic choices, like the Uninvited, who's like the second Eldritch horror that you see.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why does he just talk like a dude? Why wouldn't he talk like an otherworldly being? Like the Darkness in the first episode. Why did it just sound like a dude's voice? Why wouldn't they have put some sort of vocoder on it or made it basically sound like whispers? Or like, there are a million ways that you could do little world building things to make these shows not fucking suck.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, here we are. Also, Kieran Shipka can't act to save her fucking life or sing. And we have to watch her do both these things.
But fun fact about Bridgerton, Vitamin String Quartet had a role in my wedding, but don't tell them because we didn't pay them.
I'll let that sit. Brian, beyond that weird fun fact, is there anything you watch that you want to say, hey, check it out?
Yeah, and that's all I'm going to say. I'm just going to say, hey, check it out, and I'm going to wait for you two to see it because it's very rare non-horror, I will say. It's very rare non-horror that the three of us all would really like a movie, I think. And Promising Young Women is definitely one
on
that I
the
think
list.
All three of us would really like. So I'm waiting for you guys
to watch
it.
Is that available at? Because that was something that I was like super stoked to see in theaters when I was seeing this ad.
It's not available. I went to iPick.
Yeah. That's just leave it at it's not.
Okay. Well then, just trying to get sued by them and the Vitamin String Quartet. Got it. So
No, it's me being an asshole, not me being a criminal.
So I have two documentaries that I watched, and one is on Shudder, so everybody can watch it, and then the other one I only was able to get through ordering a disc in the mail from Netflix. But the one that's on Shudder that everyone can see is Blood and Flesh, The Real Life and Ghastly Death of Al Adamson, which is a fascinating combination of two of our favorite documentaries, because on one hand it's a true crime documentary about this film director who got murdered, but for the first hour of it, it's also just the story of him as a filmmaker making all of these weird B-level exploitation films in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And as I'm watching it, I'm like, man, Brian would watch this movie and have such a long list of movies that he would want us to watch
show. Why are you suggesting this to him?
But, like, so a few of the ones that I'd actually heard of, he did, like, Psycho A Go-Go. He did Dracula versus Frankenstein in 1971. I'm going to read some of these names because, man, exploitation in the 60s and 70s. Blood of Dracula's Castle. The Fiend with an Electric Brain. The Female Bunch. Satan's Sadists. Hell's Bloody Devils. The Brain of Blood. The Blood of the Ghastly Horror. Angels, Wild Women, The Dynamite Brothers, I Spit on Your Corpse, The Blazing Stewardesses, Black Heat, Black Samurai, Dr. Dracula, Death Dimension, Carnival Magic, and then just Lost. So those were some of the classic titles that Al Adamson made. But then the other documentary that I watched that I was fucking captivated by was called Resurrect Dead, The Mystery of the Tombi Tiles, which I heard about through the Colors of the Dark podcast, which is Elric and Becca of Shockwaves fame, their new podcast. And Becca recommended this, and it was so weird because it all takes place in Philadelphia, and it's about these tiles that if you walk around the city of Philadelphia, you will see on the streets.
Yeah.
That say, like, Resurrect Dead, movie 2001, Resurrect Dead on planet Jupiter. And it basically is these three art students from Philly who kept seeing these tiles and became obsessed with the history of the tiles, and, like, them going crazy trying to figure out who is making these tiles, what's the message he's trying to send to people. And it's just a really captivating watch, and it's like a quick 80-minute documentary. If you can find it, it's definitely low budget. It's like a documentary that's made out of like 7 people interviews total, but you're so hooked on the mystery. You're like, I need to figure out what's going on.
You want to know something funny about my picks? You guys got saved because I didn't feel like doing a bit for 2 hours because it was a 2-hour movie, but you should avoid those documentaries just to get inside the mind for the listeners. I almost picked a 70s horror called The Mephisto Waltz, and it's a 2-hour cult movie, but I almost only picked it because Alan Alda is the star, and I just am so interested in him being like, oh, hey, Satan's here, huh? Hey, spooky. What are you guys doing over here?
Amazing. So talking about 70s exploitation horror, tune in next week when we discuss some 70s exploitation horrors picked by Brian. But in the meantime, hit up our Patreon, patreon.com/HMN podcast, or subscribe to the podcast. God forbid, I've heard rumors that there are people that listen to our show, but they haven't subscribed on anything. What the hell is that about? So go ahead and subscribe, rate, and review so we know that you're out there. Thanks, guys, and we'll be back next week.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.